call to order the Atascadero Planning Commission meeting of December 7th, 2010. And Commissioner Schmidt, would you lead us in the pledge to our flag?
Today is a very important day. It's December 7th, Pearl Harbor Day. So when we say the pledge, let's think of that situation. Let's think of the people who are fighting battles for us today also. Thank you. Please put your hand over your heart to follow.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Thank you.
Roll call, please, Annette.
Commissioner Carl Marino?
Here.
Commissioner Schmidt?
Here.
Commissioner Ward?
Here.
Commissioner Sturdivant?
Here.
Vice Chairperson Benz?
Present.
And Chairperson Moreno?
Here.
All present.
I have a motion for an approval of the agenda.
So moved.
Second.
I have a motion by Vice Chairperson Benz and second by Commissioner Sturdivant. Roll call, please.
Vice Chairperson Benz?
Yes.
Commissioner Sturdivant?
Yes.
Commissioner Carl Marino?
Yes.
Commissioner Schmidt?
Yes.
Commissioner Ward?
Yes.
Chairperson Moreno?
Yes.
Motion passes 6-0.
Thank you. This portion of our meeting is reserved for public comment. Do I have a motion for the consent calendar?
So moved.
Do I have a second for the consent calendar? A motion by Vice Chairperson Benz, second by Commissioner Sturdivant. Roll call, please.
Vice Chairperson Benz?
Yes.
Commissioner Sturdivant?
Yes.
Commissioner Ward?
Yes.
Commissioner Schmidt?
Yes.
Commissioner Carl Marino?
Yes.
Chairperson Moreno?
Yes.
Motion passes 6-0.
Thank you. And on to our public hearings.
Good evening, Chairperson Moreno. The first item on the agenda is PLN 2008-1273, CUP 2008-20223 at 7055 El Camino Real. It's an amendment to a conditional use permit to allow an additional drive-through restaurant facility. The project location is at 7055 El Camino Real with APN number 030081041. It's approximately 3 acres. Its zoning is commercial retail, and its general plan is general commercial. This is an aerial photograph of the proposed project site. This site was approved in 2008 for a conditional use permit to allow approximately 17,000 square foot new Rite Aid, which is shown right here in the red arrow. This Rite Aid moved from its old location at 7055 and is now a vacant building. What you're seeing tonight will be the amendment to the conditional use permit is to allow for an additional drive-through facility. That drive-through facility will be a part of the existing Starbucks, which is right here adjacent to the Vaughn Center. Currently, the applicant is proposing that the existing Starbucks move locations to the new location at 7055 and be partitioned off a portion of the vacant building. A little bit of background for the Planning Commission in regards to this approval. In 2008, the Planning Commission approved a master plan of development that included a 17,340 square foot new Rite Aid with a pharmacy drive-through. Preliminary designs were approved for the remodel of the vacant building, which is considered the former Rite Aid in the staff report. The new Rite Aid was completed in July 2010, and again, as stated before, the applicant is proposing revisions to the approved CUP tonight. The proposed amendment to the CUP is adding an additional drive-through facility for restaurant use. As stated, a portion of the vacant building will be occupied by Starbucks. The existing Starbucks would relocate to take advantage of the proposed new drive-through. Also, in addition to the drive-through, there's also proposed revised architectural elevations that differ slightly from what was approved back in 2008. The applicant is proposing tonight a new drive-through facility, as well as proposed parking bay reconstruction to accommodate the drive-through facility, the facade, as well as the rear elevation that's facing the residential neighborhood. Again, this graphic shows the area of elimination of parking, and then the replacement of the double parking aisle with a single parking aisle. Access will remain the same from Highway 41, so cars will be able to navigate both a left turn in and a right turn out from Highway 41, as well as exiting the proposed development. The applicant is also proposing an outdoor patio that's connected to the new Starbucks, as well as the parking reconfiguration. The parking for the total project, this is inclusive of both the proposed retail uses in the former vacant shell, the Starbucks, and the new Rite Aid. The total of 104 parking spaces will be accommodated on site for all the uses. In addition to the parking, there are walkways will be provided for pedestrians, as well as an ADA accessible path. This ADA accessible path is from Santa Isabel, and then it cuts over utilizing the existing path and utilizing new sidewalks next to the drive-thru facility, and then able to access the Starbucks. The green dot, as shown on the screen, is the actual proposed path for the drive-thru facility. The drive-thru facility will utilize the parking bays that are adjacent to the drive-thru aisle, and then cut over to the next aisle, and then utilize. It's sort of confusing, but it's giving the drive-thru the ability to create additional queuing for more vehicles to utilize the drive-thru itself. A concern that was brought about is pedestrian connectivity between the new Rite Aid, the Starbucks, and Colony Square, which is adjacent across the street from the new Rite Aid and proposed Starbucks. The two green circles that you see on your screen are crosswalks that have lighted or signalized intersections. And the green arrow here is shown as a path of connectivity that takes one from Colony Square and the proposed Galaxy Theaters that are under construction, and gives a pedestrian the ability to cross the street and walk over to the new Starbucks. The second area of pedestrian connectivity is utilizing El Camino Real across Highway 41, and then going down south towards the new Rite Aid, and then cutting back up and making their way up to the northern portion of the development. There is an alternative second access, which is the parking aisle that's adjacent to Highway 41. This will be a non-sign access, but it would also be give drivers the ability to utilize that, especially during the PM hours or hours where there really aren't many cars utilizing the drive-thru. And then staff has been working with the applicant, and we came up with a pretty good solution to some of the queuing issues, is creating a left-turn exit only to guide drivers to El Camino Real. This exit is shown here, sort of beginning to channel drivers to make a left turn and utilize the signalized intersection at El Camino Real and the Highway 101 interchange. As a part of the amendment to the conditional use permit, city staff requested a supplemental analysis to process the amendment. This analysis updated the traffic study that was completed as part of the original application in 2008. The analysis that was provided by the traffic consultant included anticipated traffic from Colony Square. The supplemental analysis assumed a couple items. The first one is that the existing building would have retail uses. And it also assumed that traffic already generated by the Starbucks that's adjacent to Vaughn's today would be diverted to the new site on the proposed COP. Upon completion of the entire project, which is the Rite Aid, Starbucks, and retail uses that are in the vacant shell, the site is expected to generate approximately 3,000 average daily trips, 233 of those trips during the AM peak, 211 of those trips during the PM peak. Primary trips are those trips that mainly, you know, if you're going out to the grocery store and that's your intention is to go to Vaughn's, that's considered a primary trip, whereas, say, my intention is to go to the Galaxy Theater, but I need to stop and get some candy at Rite Aid, that would be considered a secondary trip. Approximately 70% of the total trips are considered primary for this new center, or for the revised center. The traffic analysis also touched a little bit about the parking demands, and the traffic study itself determined that the demand for parking, specifically in the center, really intensifies after 11 o'clock in the morning. The drive-through peak period for drive-through coffee shops such as Starbucks really is prior to 9 a.m. So what this means is, even though the drive-through aisle, the queuing is actually within the parking bay, a lot of it, in terms of being used by customers, is really before 11 a.m., which means that a lot of the queue and parking really won't affect each other. The analysis also included turning volumes at driveways, and this is really critical for us to determine delays, especially at the Highway 41 driveway and the El Camino Real. So this supplemental traffic. In addition to the drive-thru facility, the applicant is proposing facade improvements that differ slightly from the original CUP. What you see on your screen is the approved conceptual elevations that were approved by the Planning Commission in 2008. This shows the tile roof up here where the proposed drive-through facility is, as well as pop-outs at the corner and at the center of the now vacant shell. The west elevation does differ due to the drive-through, and the architectural pop-outs are now at the center of the building, rather at the corner and at the center. The tile roof elements are also included similar to Rite Aid, and awnings and lighting stay consistent with the approved conceptual schematic. Stone veneers, landscaping will add some additional depth and variety, as well as a color scheme that's very similar to what's seen now at the new Rite Aid, as well as the Carl's Jr. and Lube & Go. These are the proposed architectural elevations that the applicant is showing tonight. Again, this is the tile roof element, which differs from the first and approved CUP. There is a pop-out for the drive-through itself, and as included are the awnings, and you can see the stone veneers on both elevations, as well as the additional landscaping along the drive-through. The project also includes a signage program. The approved CUP included a signage program for major tenants, that's 10,000 square foot or more, had approximately 65 square feet of signage. Signage for other tenants would be limited to only 25 square feet. The corner tenant, as part of the original CUP, was considered a major tenant, and they were allowed the maximum of 65 square feet. The proposed Starbucks is a corner tenant, and their wall signs are approximately 100 square feet. The wall signs include the typical Starbucks coffee sign that you see on most stores, as well as the new black drive-through logo that is shown with that is similar to the one that is at the Home Depot Center. Staff is recommending that condition 12 be modified to allow additional square footage in order to have better visual recognition for drivers off of Highway 41 as well as Highway 101 coming off of El Camino Real, as well as capture more traffic from existing residents. In addition to the wall sign, the Starbucks is also proposing drive-through signage, as well as a heights restriction bar that includes the Starbucks logo on top of the restriction bar, giving motorists the ability to see if they can actually clear and make the drive-through. There was also a preview menu that is included on most, that is standard on most drive-throughs nowadays. And also the official menu board where one goes up to order a drink or whatever else they're ordering at the proposed Starbucks. Staff is recommending that the amendment to the master Jewish trees in the rear to better stabilize the hillside that's there, as well as give residents that are fronting onto the back of the center, give them a better visual appeal. Staff has determined that the mitigated negative declaration that was certified as a part of the CUP is consistent with this proposal tonight. Although additional traffic will be generated, the driveways and internal circulation will continue to function at acceptable levels consistent with the general plan. As a part of the CUP amendment, Planning Commission must make the following findings. The proposed project is consistent with the general plan and appearance review manual. The proposed project satisfies all applicable zoning provisions. The operation will not be detrimental to health, welfare, and safety of residents. The proposed project will not be inconsistent with surrounding neighborhood character. And the proposed project will not generate a volume of traffic beyond the safe capacity of roadways. Staff has concluded that based on the proposal that is before you tonight, that the Planning Commission make those findings. The proposed amendment is consistent with the approved CUP and ultimate intent to renovate the existing vacant building. The revised master plan development covers standards for the project. Really what you're deciding here tonight is the additional drive-through. Staff has determined, per the staff report, that the architectural elevations that were submitted by the applicant are in substantial conformance. So really what we're looking at is the Planning Commission to approve the additional drive-through facility on the site. It is our recommendation that staff adopt PC 2010-0024, amending PLN 2008-1273 and CUP 2008-0223 to allow an additional drive-through facility as part of the renovation and remodel of the existing 21,500 square foot retail building at 7055 El Camino Real, based on findings and subject to conditions of approval, and mitigation monitoring consistent with the adopted mitigated negative declaration. You have three alternatives tonight. One is that the Commission may recommend modifications to any of the amendments and conditions of approval. Two, the Commission may continue the hearing and refer the item back to staff for additional information or analysis. And the third is the Commission may deny the request for the amendment, specifically denying the request for the additional drive-through. All approved conditions will remain in place, and the remodel may move forward consistent with previous project approvals. And with that, I open it up to questions from the Planning Commission.
Thank you, Alfredo. Let me begin with any, if we have any ex parte to disclose, starting with Commissioner Schmidt.
I sent an email to Alfredo this morning asking questions about circulation concerns that I had, and he responded to those, and we can talk about those.
And then I asked him some questions about the Rite Aid building, and he sort of gave me a little rundown on the type of architectural improvements, and I told him I thought it would look very good. I did not comment about any of the details of matters that we were going to approve.
Okay, thank you. All right, with that, do we have any questions for staff? Commissioner Schmidt.
Yeah, thank you. I've heard comments from listening to public hearings in this forum here about our community having too many drive-throughs. Has anyone provided comment to staff that's not present about this drive-through?
No, not at this time.
Thank you. Previously, this commission has had to deal with granting permits for drive-throughs, namely, I think it was the Carl's Jr. facility that had been moved out of. With respect to the drive-through component on this building, if Starbucks, for whatever reason, leaves that location, what happens with the drive-through component? Does it will it expire if someone is not moved in within a six-month period, or will it stay for the next use?
It would stay for the next use. At this point, the applicant has requested the amendment, and just to clarify sort of the construction timeline for Starbucks and for the proposed renovated shell, the applicant is intending to move fairly quickly to get both the shell renovation started as well as getting the Starbucks sort of portion carved out and get that under construction as soon as possible. So the reality at this point is more than likely, if the commission were to approve the application tonight, construction would start in earnest to hopefully get the thing completed as early as March of 2011.
So a timing with Galaxy is would be a hopeful guess, I guess?
Yes, hopefully. I mean, if all goes according to plan and Galaxy opens up in March, you could easily have the Galaxy Theater opened up along with potentially some shops as a part of Colony Square. And then obviously Starbucks would move locations over from Vaughn's and take advantage of a new drive-thru. So again, if Planning Commission approves the application tonight, one can theoretically potentially go to Shell.
Yes.
The applicant at this point has actually submitted building plans to the building department and planning department for the Shell actually first. The Shell, so the drawings are sitting at, you know, waiting plan check at this point based on whether the Planning Commission makes a determination tonight. So the applicant is, Starbucks is really the catalyst to moving forward of completing the remodel for the Shell as well as Starbucks.
With that in mind, then, to talk to the other commission members, I had expressed some comments and concerns about circulation to Alfredo, and part of it had to do with the pedestrian path that led through the project to Santa Isabel. Others dealt with whether the PM peak trips that are shown on the engineer's report included movements coming out of Colony Square as it was passing from the east to the west along Highway 41. Talked a little bit about PM business and how it would be helpful once the theater opens. I see a lot of people wandering across the way to Starbucks there, and talked a little bit about how those movements would occur. I also reviewed with him, again, more about the PM pedestrians movement, more about the left turn turnout that is shown on the drive-through. As you pull out of the drive-through, there's a left turn only. And I had expressed that in other areas in our community where we have this movement where we're pushing people to the right or to the left, I often see people turning into Namely, it's over by the Chase Bank over there on the south end of town. People traveling south along El Camino Real will turn in instead of going to the street and working their way around. And I see that also in front of the Rite Aid here. And so I'm a little concerned about pushing that movement to the left. I think that that could create confusion and conflict. And personally, I would rather have it go both ways. I understand why staff and the engineer, traffic engineer, is doing what they're doing, and again, is to reduce the queue at that turning movement on Highway 41.
Okay, Commissioner Schmidt, could you clarify your concern then? It's that you think if we try to make them go left, they're going to go right anyway?
I think it was 6,000 square feet of storage in the Rite Aid's shell. And that loading dock that's behind the Starbucks is the only access point to that storage area. There's no other way you can get to that building beyond that point there, or you could do it out front, I guess. And so I was concerned about the queue that they're talking in, that if there's queue there and a truck is wanting to make a delivery, how does the truck make the delivery with the queue winding through that area? And then how does the truck get into that area? They're going to have to back in to get into that area. So I see likely they'll turn off of Highway 41, turn right, kind of past the Rite Aid, and then start backing in, and then backing in all the way back to the loading dock. And so I was a little surprised about the facade being done, because one of the comments that Alfredo had made is that the applicant wasn't dealing necessarily with the rest of the shell, but it seems like he is, mm-hmm. or they are. And then my last question had to do with a couple more questions. One about whether there was a consideration of driveway off of Santa Isabel, and I thought the flow would be a little bit better, but there is concern about the relationship of that driveway to the intersection, which I can understand. Mm-hmm. And then I also expressed concern about lighting along the path coming off of Santa Isabel into the Starbucks, and whether there was be safe lighting in that area, because I'm thinking about, I don't know how late Starbucks stays open, but you know, we have young people who'll be going to the movies primarily. If they go across the street to the Starbucks, will it be safe for them to make that trip, and should we have some lighting along that path to make it safer for them? So those are the areas that I spoke to him about. Alfredo answered most of the questions to my satisfaction. I can go over it if you want.
Maybe specifically about the loading dock and the deliveries, and then the lighting for the walk path.
With respect to the lighting, he had mentioned that there was lighting at the intersection, and that there was lighting in the parking lot, and that lighting would cover that area. We don't have a illuminate. The AMPQ will block access to the loading dock. However, it is anticipated that the drive-through aisle will be able to accommodate traffic during other hours of the day. Depending on and if when the loading bay is utilized, there may be conflicts with the vehicle queues for the drive-through. The applicant has not addressed this issue at this time. So that was the response to that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Commissioner Sturdivant.
Just a quick question about pedestrian traffic, because that was kind of a concern of mine as well. As I was thinking about people not so much using Santa Isabel, but using the El Camino, because you have to go up by the Rite Aid. And is there actually a designated from I guess it would be northeast of Rite Aid across to that parking lot by Starbucks? Is there actually, because I drove through there, I don't remember seeing any kind of a crosswalk or designated crosswalk or anything like that.
You mean crossing the driveway on Highway 41?
It'd be leaving the Rite Aid building, going northeast and straight across to the, if you were going to walk, right across there.
At this point, there is not, but as a part of the project submittal and as a part of the conditions, the path of travel is supposed to utilize stamped concrete or other additional materials to heighten awareness for pedestrians to utilize that.
Excellent. Thank you.
Commissioner Ward.
Yes, just briefly, Actually, I read all this stuff. On page 52, mitigation measures 3B5, it talks about signage, directing the drivers to shut their engine off when they're loading and unloading, but, you know, that may save gas, but a lot of those trucks have refrigeration units, and they're required to keep the, you know, the engine moving. I think that's, I don't know how that could be enforced. But the other thing is to have a sign directing the drivers to shut their engines off when they're in line to get a cup of coffee. And I envision people driving up, stopping, shutting the engine off, 2 minutes later, driving up, shutting the engine off two or three times, and I think that's a little bit foolish. And if the intent is related to global warming or to save gasoline, I think it's misdirected. And I don't know whether there's such a recommendation for all the other drive-ins at fast food places. And how could this be enforced?
I know this from experience.
So you sound like a...
Yeah. So specifically, that's dealing with the large truck deliveries from Rite Aid. And again, that was a part of the mitigated negative declaration. So it's sort of the environmental framework. That's sort of a standard condition by the Air Pollution Control District. It's pretty standard package. You'll see that included in, say, larger big box stores or grocery stores, etc. So it's not necessarily pertaining to the folks in the drive-through, because, to be quite honest, it's very inefficient for a catalytic converter to be shut off and on. It's actually more efficient just to stay idling. So hopefully that answers your question.
So will there actually be that signage then that tells the people in the drive-through to not idle?
The signage would actually be located at the dock. For all intents and purposes, it would be actually at the docking bay of the vacant shell, and as well as it's required for the new Rite Aid.
Okay. Commissioner Colomarino.
Yes, I have a few questions. One relating to the square footage that Starbucks is going to use. Its new facility, I guess, will use 1,650 square feet indoors. Is that right?
That's correct.
And do you know what they're using now at their existing facility, how much indoor space they have?
That I do not know offhand.
You know, so you don't know whether it's smaller than 1650 or larger?
I really don't know. I mean, it looks comparatively the same. Then again, they all look the same. But, I mean, it has your basic setup of the counter and chairs and, you know, tables, so it has a good mix. So I'd say comparatively it's about the same.
And then there's patio space too here. Approximately how much square footage of patio space will there be?
Again, I don't remember offhand. The applicant may be able to answer those questions a little bit more thoroughly than I can at this point. However, the patio space does have, I believe it's eight tables.
Eight tables?
Yeah. So it's a pretty good sized patio space, especially to be utilized during the summer or, you know, during the fall, during good weather times.
Now, the other thing is I'd like to make sure I understand exactly how this drive-through path is going to go. I looked at the, you know, the plans and everything, and I looked at your moving... Maybe you can animate the green dot this time somehow.
Trying to get there. That's what happens with technology.
All right.
Okay. We should all get through the drive-through that quickly.
So... So what will define this little labyrinth that the cars not the green dot, be moving through. Will there be plantings? How will this how will the corridors be established?
The drive-through signage will establish the actual path of where one should enter. So as stated as part of the conditions of approval, there would be signage here, and then more than likely one of these two bays directing traffic back to the drive-through aisle. Now, again, there's a secondary non-signed access. So essentially, you know, i.e. me as a driver at maybe, you know, 5 o'clock in the afternoon, I can eventually just be able to shoot through here and not even bother with the labyrinth of, you know.
So that will be permissible to do that?
Correct, but it won't be signed. So, you know, it's really just trying to capture those folks that don't know the area or don't go there very often. They will obviously follow the sign.
Well, what's to prevent somebody from, you know, trying to take that shortcut? You know, even, I mean, will the signage be clear enough to make it to make them know that it's mandatory to follow the, you know, the labyrinth? Because I could easily imagine somebody being confused and taking the shortest path when they come in from Highway 41. That's what I'm a little uncertain about. And I thought maybe there were planters or something that would establish a corridor so that the cars would be channeled. Maybe there should be road markings, but something I would think would be needed to avoid confusing motorists as they come in.
I think ultimately what we're concerned about is if you look at the distance between the first driveway and 41, it's very waiting for a car to move to try to turn into that first driveway that they can see, oh, I'll go to the next one. So we're hoping that during those peaks that the signage will be clear enough that people won't sit there and block the rest of the intersection waiting for that car to move, and they'll go that way. Obviously, both will be equally accessible, and people will, you know, will obviously use which one's more convenient. But we do think it will help at the peak, and that is the time that we're most concerned about traffic.
So then you're saying the only concern relates to periods, times when their cars are backed up as they're trying to leave the shopping strip, the mall, and get out to 41. And when they're not backed up, you're not worried that a motorist is going to be confused and just go in there?
Well, if there's no cars there, then there's no problem if they turn early. We just don't want somebody sitting there waiting to turn in because they didn't know they could go to the next driveway to get through.
Yeah. Well, I guess my thought is it would be good to not just hope this, but be sure that the signage is as clear as possible to minimize the potential of confusion, because it seems to me that it could arise fairly easily. Then you mentioned some traffic counts. The traffic counts, I guess, related to the entire shopping center there, including Vons. Is that right?
No. The traffic counts that are included in the report, as well as supplemental traffic analysis that was done by the applicant's traffic engineer, strictly applies to the new Rite Aid, the proposed Starbucks, and retail use similar to that of Rite Aid. We have our city traffic engineer tonight, David Athey, who may be able to elaborate a little bit better on that.
But this retail use is going to go into the rest of the old Rite Aid building? Is that what you're thinking?
The access will still be there. That's available to go into, you know, you turn on off of Highway 41 onto that driveway, go to Starbucks, you can use it, go to Central Coast Pizza, you can use it, go to Vons, you know, Tool Outlet. Access to the entire shopping center is still available from this driveway.
But those other retail outlets are not included in these traffic counts.
That is correct.
Right. So to a large extent, the traffic count is hypothetical because we have no idea what businesses are going to be in there and what times of day they're going to be pulling customers, right?
Well, the existing counts that were taken back in 2008, if you were to, it's sort of a snapshot in time. So there were existing counts that were completed. And so if I were a driver and I utilized that driveway,
the definition of primary related to not just Starbucks, but anything in the old Rite Aid building and the new Rite Aid building.
That is correct. So in this instance, the primary is considered Rite Aid, obviously, that's as the anchor.
Right.
And then with the proposed Starbucks if your primary and sole trip was to just go to Starbucks, and it would, that would be considered a primary trip.
Yeah, so the old Rite Aid building and the new Rite Aid building, and then secondary is traffic that's going elsewhere in the shopping center.
Correct, and I believe it's considered pass-through traffic or pass-by traffic.
Okay, one last thing. Commissioner Schmidt brought up the question of pedestrian access over Highway 41. I just want to be clear on that. I thought you implied that there might be some crosswalk going in there, a something stamped concrete. I'm not sure, though. What were you saying about that?
It's part of the condition of approval on the site, on the center itself. Public Works has made a condition that stamped concrete be utilized to delineate the access to the path of access for ADA accessibility. And so that typically is where a pedestrian would cross to utilize the sidewalk as well in the center itself, but not on Highway 41 and not on El Camino Real or anything like that.
So then the stamped concrete would show a path going down to El Camino Real? Is that?
No, it would. It's in this instance, the stamped concrete would be sort of, as Commissioner Sternovan had pointed out, where there's a crossing between New Rite Aid and Starbucks, that's where the stamped concrete would go, but not outside of the center.
Okay. So that really doesn't relate to pedestrian movements across Highway 41?
No, it does not.
And there, the crosswalk is going to be at El Camino Real, and then there's another one over by Santa Isabel.
Yes, those are existing crosswalks today. So if you were to go out tonight to walk on over to Bonds, you can utilize the existing crosswalk that's there that has a pedestrian signal as well.
Thank you.
Vice Chairperson Benz.
Yes, Alfredo. On page 45, condition 8, all parking spaces shall be shortened to the minimum length prescribed for parking spaces by the Atascadero Municipal Code for non-wheel stop spaces. Are you going to shorten? Oh, I see.
So it's we're amending the original CUP, so rather than writing new resolutions. And
I thought maybe we came up with a business-friendly idea.
Let's see. Alfredo, with the issue of coming out of the drive-through, is there a way to do something to ensure that hard left, that people can't make a right coming out of there?
Currently, right now, as written, there is a condition of approval that left turn is to be approved by our city engineer. At this point, as Commissioner Schmidt had pointed out, people do, they don't follow the rules. Well, that happens a lot, even with speed limits posted at 45. Well, how many people actually go 45?
So you have experience with that as well as Starbucks?
I have some good stories, but it's not tonight. What we're doing is there'll be signage, obviously pointing to make a left turn only. There will be striping as well, and then being able to channel, making sure that curb radius is severe enough to really force a driver to make a left turn. And really the intention is a safety issue, and it's a queuing issue. It's much better for the driver to utilize the El Camino Real signalized intersection versus utilizing the driveway. It's just much more efficient, as well as it helps out on the queuing issue. So really, as staff, we've sort of conditioned as much as we possibly can with signage, with striping, and with utilizing a severe enough curb radius that needs to be approved by the city engineer.
So the severe curb angling, that is already part of this condition. There's nothing additional that we would need to do to help ensure that if we chose to.
That's correct, because the channeling needs to be approved by our city engineer.
Okay.
So the city engineer will be working with the applicant to ensure that hopefully that left turn channelization is severe enough to really force a driver's hand. Now,
okay,
if they decide to make a right turn, then decide to make a right turn.
Well, you could always, put spikes or something, when it's like, don't back up or strips. Okay. All right. Thank you. Well, I think maybe we'll go ahead and open up to the applicant if you would like to come to the lectern. Make sure the microphone is on. I know there should be a...
How about now?
There you go. Thank
Perfect.
You.
Well, thank you for
hearing us today.
Your name, sir?
I'm Tom Jess. I'm with Aris Studio Architects, and I'm representing, did an excellent job previewing the project, running you through the process. I don't need to stand here and redo what he did. I think primarily I'm here if there's questions. Couple things I did want to clarify. When the traffic study, the original traffic study was done, it did take into account the Colony Square project. It took into account the Colony Square project at full build-out, which included 67 townhouses, 75,000 square feet of retail, 15,000 or 17,000 square feet of office space. So it really is a conservative number that's used in terms of generating the traffic counts from the original traffic study that formed the basis for the revised traffic study that we did in association with this particular project. And the other thing to point out is that really the CUP that was approved in 2008 for the new Rite Aid was essentially the first phase of that project, and then renovating the existing Rite Aid, or the old Rite Aid, is the second phase. And during the process of moving into that second phase, really the catalyst, as Alfredo pointed out, for this remodel is the drive-through Starbucks. I mean, Starbucks is going to relocate within the same center just for the sake of getting the drive-through. It means that much to them. And the fact that we do have the drive-through Starbucks going in is what's going to allow us to renovate the shell. And just to be clear, the renovation, what we're proposing to do right now is renovate the entire exterior of the building, not just the Starbucks portion. We're going to renovate the entire exterior. The interior portion that's not the Starbucks is going to remain a shell at this time until we do get a tenant for that space. And we're hoping that it would be a lot easier to get a tenant into that space when they can drive through and look at a nice, attractive building rather than what they're looking at now. So we're really hoping that it really gets the ball rolling. Obviously, Galaxy Theater's coming in, the other shops associated with Colony Square coming in. There's a lot of momentum in this area, and we're hoping to capture some of that with this proposal that we have before you. Trying to see if I can answer any of these questions preemptively. The pedestrian lighting, that was a concern. As Alfredo mentioned, we've actually progressed along in this just because Starbucks has a really aggressive time frame. So we have been working with our engineers and getting the actual construction drawings done in advance. And working with the electrical engineer, we've actually doubled the amount of lighting in this area because of the activity that's associated with the drive-through rather than just a parking lot. Whereas I think there was two heads out there currently. We're putting in, it'll be a total of four heads, plus building-mounted lights. So it will be a... We'd like to retain its use, although we're not proposing to do anything with it right now. And we went out there and looked at it this evening before we came over here to see if there really is any practical way to get a driveway from Santa Isabel up there to avoid the backing. And although I think the grades can accommodate it, I would be concerned about its proximity to the corner. It really is pretty close to the corner. We could maybe move it off so it's maybe 30 feet off, but it's still pretty close to that corner, and I'd be concerned about. And then the other thing is that we would have to restrict it for service vehicles only, because if a regular pedestrian vehicle tried to use, or a regular commercial vehicle tried to use that, they would be coming in the wrong way into the drive-thru and would really cause a lot of confusion. So like I said, although I think it's physically possible, I do have some traffic concerns that it would create other issues. And then as far as the signing for the drive-thru entrance and the labyrinth, as it's been referred to get there, when we came in initially, the only drive-through entrance was the straight shot right by Highway 41. And then when we worked with staff, the concern came up that if more than two or three cars are backed up waiting to make a right-hand turn or a left-hand turn out of the driveway into Highway 41, onto Highway 41, that could back up and prevent people from using the drive-through. So the alternative came to provide an alternate entrance that's the next driveway down, where it would take five or six or seven cars to back up to block that one, so it would allow free access, and having that as an alternate entrance to the drive-through seemed to alleviate the problem of cars backing out onto Highway 41 waiting for someone to make a left. You know, it is kind of an alternate. It doesn't necessarily mean that you have to follow the labyrinth to use it. There's no penalty. You don't get docked points or anything if you just go straight into the drive-through. And then trying to think. Oh, and then the left-hand turn, I think Alfredo and addressed that well, is that we have the striping, the curb radius, and the signage, and, you know, forcing people to make a left-hand turn However, and I think that that's going to capture the majority of the people, and that's really what we're trying to do. There's really no serious concern on a regular basis if someone does make a right-hand turn. I mean, there's no harm done. You're not going into oncoming traffic or anything like that. But if we can encourage the majority of the people to make a left-hand turn and do that as strongly as we can without punitive aspects, then that'll help to alleviate the queuing on to Highway 41. And that was really the genesis of that, about the space. But I believe it's approximately the same. And then I can touch on the square footage of the patio.
Yes.
The patio is about 260 square feet, because the Starbucks minimum was 200, you know, their requirement was 250, and we're right at that. We're a little bit over that with 260. And the reason for that is actually the walkway that's currently in front of Rite Aid is too steep to be accessible. So we're having to create a new handicap accessible ramp around the patio. You can see it in the diagram in the site plan. So that what we're doing is providing an accessible route from Santa Isabella and Highway 41 to the existing Rite Aid that did not exist before. So we're creating that as part of this scope.
And you had mentioned that the main attraction of making this move for Starbucks is to get a drive-through. It also appears, and correct me if I'm wrong, it appears Starbucks is going to have greatly enhanced street presence, especially with the signage that's going to be a little enlarged. It'll be visible from Highway 41. The corner location also gives it greater presence in the mall itself. And then the patio seating adds some capacity and some attractiveness to it as a place to go. So it looks like a nice, advantageous move for Starbucks here and for the community, for that matter.
Well, we certainly hope so.
Commissioner Schmidt.
Yes, thank you, Tom. With respect to the left turn from driving out, do you know the distance from that turning movement to the driveway?
I don't know it off the top of my head. No, it's, well, we can figure it out. How many parking bays is it? The parking bay is 18 feet and the drive aisle is 24. You know, if we.
Yeah. So you have three bays and two drives. 48.
Maybe 100 feet?
Yeah. Well, I was thinking, in the traffic report talked about the PMP queue was, what, five cars, right? And so mm-hmm. I went 18 feet times five is 80 feet. And so I'm wondering, if you had a preference, would you not have the left turn only? Would you want to have a right-hand turn?
Well, our initial proposal was to have a right and a left out of there. And I think that
the signals and the timing of those signals to make it either a left-hand turn or a straight-through movement through that intersection. You've expressed a lot of concerns about circulation within the remodeling that you're doing, but I'm still a little bit confused about the delivery bay that is there. And to me, I'm surprised that you aren't concerned about that. And what it really triggered it for me was that you're having this queuing movement. You know, people are going to be pulling into the Starbucks. I don't see the ultimate queue, which was, 11 cars, I think it was talked about, and that's why we had the labyrinth work through. But I do see cars reaching out to that point where they would block the delivery bay or one more car from there. And not to say, you know, when deliveries are going to be made, but it seems to me that you're going to be limiting delivery to that six, to the remaining shell because of the queue. And how is that going to possibly help the leasability of the remaining site? I mean, if I'm someone who wants to have a business there and I have deliveries that come in and I don't want them necessarily to come in at 1 o'clock or 2 o'clock in the morning because I have to have employees there, I want them to come at these other times. And again, there could be conflicts there. Why isn't there a concern for that?
Well, I wouldn't go as far as to say there's no concern. I certainly understand your concern, but I think the old adage of a bird in the hand comes into play, where we have the Starbucks and making the drive-through work. I think the drive-through works the way it's shown. It works from a traffic standpoint. And I think that during certain times of day, there will be conflicts with the loading dock and whether or not loading trucks can access the loading dock. But I think that that's the case already existing there, just because, and that's the case in a lot of loading docks, unless it's like a Vons where it's in the back of the house. If there's a loading dock that's accessed from the same parking lot as the customers, there's potential for conflict at any time. And I think that retailers are very acute to that, and they're very good at organizing delivery times, coordinating with that. I think looking at the traffic study and analyzing drive-through coffee shops, the peak hours are pretty concentrated in terms of when customers are visiting, you know, in mass quantity.
Sod or a single occupant.
Well, there's potential to divide it up. And what our goal right now is flexibility. We don't know which type of tenant we're going to be able to attract to this space, whether it's a single tenant or whether it's multiple tenants. We're as part of this proposal, we're switching out all the electrical switch gear so that it can accommodate multiple tenants. We're setting up the space so that it can accommodate multiple tenants. But if a single tenant came in, I think we've designed the elevations in such a way that a single tenant would look appropriate for that space, and it would function well as if there was multiple tenants, you know, we could divide it. What we're trying to do is build in the flexibility to be as attractive to as broad an audience as possible.
I think, you know, from my perspective, dealing with the delivery issue that I've identified, that the need for the delivery bay goes away with the multiple tenants, and you're, you know, smaller uses, more ma and pa type things, and as Alfredo had talked to me, more van type deliveries than truck type deliveries that mm-hmm. would be with a single occupant, and that's where I would see again the conflict for a single occupant, you know, wanting that space and then considering that conflict that could be there. The other side of it is that, you know, maybe I'm not knowing what Starbucks is paying to get their lease. I mean, that might make up for the cost that the and somewhere else. I mean, it is a very important move for them, and it's really going to add a lot to this area. And the relationship between the theater and this is going to be, I think, extraordinary. Hopefully it's not going to be so much of a problem that people are going to be running across the street at time and will use the crosswalk. But, I mean, like has been stated, you know, people are going to do what they do, and hopefully we can eliminate a majority of it and have them obey the rules. So thank you for your time.
Oh, thank you. We're very excited.
Commissioner Sturdivant.
Yes, Tom, just a quick question about the outdoor patio and the left turn lane. Does that come out further than into the road? Is it going to narrow the road there between the old Rite Aid and the...
No. No, it's within the... It's the same curb line.
Same curb line? Yeah.
Correct.
Thank you.
Commissioner Ward.
Yes, Tom, I don't know whether you know this or not, but is that patio area in front of the new Starbucks, is that going to be a smoking or non-smoking area? And the reason I mention that is a patio area in front of Vons is just a classic hangout for non-Vons.
Policy on that? So maybe we should ask someone that does. Alfredo, do they allow smoking in the patio out front?
Yes, they actually they do, but we do have state laws that, you know, I don't know if the state law applies to basic commercial building, but
I don't know what the answer is.
Yeah, I really don't know what the answer is, but typically, yes, the workers and or customers who do want to smoke do smoke in the outside patio.
There's probably a distance from the front door that's a required distance, but I don't know what that is off the top of my head.
Vice Chairperson Benz.
Yes, I know what Commissioner Ward is talking about. However, I've lived here for going on my 14th year now, and I do a lot of shopping at Vons and at that center, and I have never once been upset about smoking. I've walked right through those people. I in my nose, I don't like smoke, but I've never been upset because someone was smoking out there because I didn't smell it. So, and I go in that shopping center 3 and 4 times a day, all over it. And so I've never experienced that problem with people smoking.
Thank you. Okay. With regards to coming out of the drive-thru, we were looking at the parking bay and saying there's about, 24 feet, you said, between coming out and the entrance?
That's the parking bay between the two aisles. I don't know. I think that main aisle might be a little wider than that. You know, when you're looking at the parking bays where you go in towards the drive-thru?
Right.
Those are 24. I think the main drive aisle might be wider than that, but I don't know off the top of my head. It might be 24
the distance,
is the minimum.
The distance between a car that's going into the drive-thru and coming out of the drive-thru is how many feet?
Between here and here?
Correct.
This parking space is 18.6.
So 24.
8.5 plus 15, so 23.5.
23.5, okay. Yeah. So, Alfredo, is it basically that if people are making a right-hand turn out of the... We're concerned that they're not going to be maybe paying attention. You got people making a left. Is it a potential for accidents? Is it trying to divert traffic? What's the main purpose with that?
It's more concerned with the PM peak volume of queuing, since the PM peak is actually the higher of the two. Mainly just concerned of actually beginning to stack up that drive through more and more. So if, say, there's a line waiting to hang a left onto Highway 41, and as that driver stacks up, then I'm stuck waiting to utilize, you know, just got my drink and I'm out of the drive-thru itself. I'm stuck waiting for those queue to clear up. So that way we just...
Starting from the parking bay closest to Highway 41, those are 15 feet. At least they are within the Starbucks area. So we have 315s, which is 45 feet. We have 224s, which is 48. So now we're up to 93. And then between the drive-through aisle, the drive-through aisle as you come out, they're roughly 9 feet there. And so now we're up to 102. And basically, if you look at where those two arrows are that show driving in and out at that driveway, Highway 41, I'm going to say that that's roughly, and when you look at the dimensionings everywhere else, that that's probably 20 feet or so. So now we're up to 122. And then from the property line, which is that heavy dash dot dot line, it's probably another 20 feet, which is where people are going to be parking at that point to make their left or right-hand turn out. So another 20 feet. So we're talking... You know, somewhere, could say conservatively, between 130 to 140 feet. And there's concern about queuing. Now, again, the traffic report stated that there was the PM peak queue in that area was five cars. Five cars, even times 20, which cars aren't, that would be 100 feet. And we're talking about 130 feet. So I'm... I mean, I asked the question about whether they would prefer to have both movements. I would say, I mean, the comment was yes. I don't see the problem that staff has been talking about that conflict with the queue in that area. And so we should maybe consider allowing there to be that right turn movement. And again, Tom had acknowledged, that they can't stop everyone. I mean, people will drive over the curb if they want to in that area to make that right movement. Again, everywhere else that I see these things, people constantly violate what the intent is. And again, my concern is more of someone who is driving northbound on the past the Rite Aid, the existing Rite Aid, and going out that way. And they're going to think that this person is going to make a left-hand turn to come back toward them, and they're going to turn the other way. And that's where the conflict I see is that, you know, someone's anticipating someone to do something, and it doesn't happen. It's almost like any act. Changing that particular intersection, if Starbucks wants to put it in, they can. If not, they have the option of not putting it in.
Vice Chairperson Benz.
Yes. On page 17, top of the page, it says the calculations for Highway 41 access indicate that the driveway would operate at a level of service of B during the peak AM 15-minute period. And the level of service of B indicates that there may be a 10 to 15-second delay at the intersection according to the Highway Capacity Manual. Then for the PM peak period, the driveway is expected to operate at a level of service of C with queues during this peak period of less than five vehicles. According to the HCM manual, typical delay for a vehicle at this intersection would range from 15 to 25 seconds. I think that's a level of service that is reasonable.
And so you're saying with the project conditioned as it is that where you're going with
this?
I see. I think what he's saying is the level of service that's been taken into account with forcing that left-hand turn at that particular in and out on Highway 41, that we're saying that's an acceptable level of service. And so if we change that and people are going right and using that, that would change that. Am I interpreting what you said correctly?
Do we know how much it would change that? Does the traffic engineer know that information?
Hi, David Athey, Public Works. I just want to clarify, the staff's concern is not that the left out or the driveway, the drive-through would be blocked. It's the entrances to the drive-through would be blocked, and therefore causing a person coming off of Morrill Road, turning right into the center, to stop and potentially wait for an opening to occur, and all the while folks trying to come in to that in that drive approach off of Highway 41, stopping and queuing back out into Highway 41. So given that concern, we talked with the applicant, talked about those issues, and that's where the new modified drive-through schematic came through with two new openings instead of one opening, plus a left out to reduce those queues so that we wouldn't have blocking.
Commissioner Schmidt, do you have any further questions for Mr. Athey?
No.
Okay. Okay. Commissioner Colomarino.
I think you realize that there's a lot of concern about having the most direct route between Starbucks and City Hall, so that's why we have to we have to go into this very deeply. But I understand what you're talking about and how that might be a problem. Do we have any way of knowing how realistic that fear is? I mean, do we? I guess we don't have traffic counts to work with because it hasn't been here. That we have no experience with the drive-through, so it's something where we're trying to figure out exactly how it's going to play out, huh?
Right. I mean, the only way you can really test it is would be really to build it. The applicant has estimated traffic from the proposed Starbucks using standard methods of engineering. They used a coffee shop / donut shop drive-through based on the square footage, and it's called the ITE design manual, where they actually go out and look at existing structures such as Starbucks or a donut shop with a drive-through, and come up with approximate traffic numbers, trip generation for projects. Based on that, and the short distance between, as you can see on the screen, Highway 41 and the first drive-through opening, staff feels that two cars would be able to queue there at the most. It's a steep driveway; sight distance is limited. So rather than take a chance and see how it turns out and ask the applicant later or rely on some, a goodwill to turn that back into a left drive approach, we feel it's most prudent to move forward with that left out only now. And we recognize folks will cheat that. I've seen it. I drive around town. I won't admit to doing it, but I've seen it. And I think the other option that drivers do have is to exit onto, if they want to turn right and go north on El Camino Real, would be to use the drive approach at Rite Aid, where it is a ride out, and they can access El Camino Real and go northbound.
Thank you.
Commissioner Schmidt.
Yeah, we have one area in town that I know that has a problem of queuing up, and that kind of surprisingly is Taco Bell at lunchtime. And discussed amongst the applicant and staff real thoroughly. And so I'm satisfied that everyone is aware of what is going on and they have agreed to that. So I would like to see it not there, but everyone's accepting it. And again, the analysis has been done and has been done very thoroughly. So
thank you. Do we have any other questions or concerns? Commissioner Colomarino?
I would just like to add to what Commissioner Schmidt said, the point that Mr. Athey raised about the gradient there also I think makes it a little more problematic of a place. I think drivers get a little nervous sometimes dealing with that gradient, whether they're going up or down it, and they may leave a little more space than otherwise between them and the next car, and it could cause the queuing to back up farther. So it does make sense, I think, what they're saying.
Well, do I have a motion?
Yes, I'd like to move that the Planning Commission adopt resolution PC 2010-0024, approving an amendment to the Master Plan of Development Conditional Use Permit 2008-0223 to allow an additional drive-through facility as a part of the renovation and remodel of the existing 21,500-square-foot retail building at 7055 El Camino Real, based on findings and subject to conditions of approval and mitigation monitoring consistent with adopted mitigated negative declaration.
And I second that.
A motion by Vice Chairperson Vence and a second by Commissioner Sturdivant. Roll call, please.
Could we have some comment?
Oh, I would like a little discussion. Commissioner Colomarino.
Yes, I'd just like to address the subject of this application a little bit before voting. The subject of drive-thrus, I think, just needs to be touched on. It was brought up before, and we've talked about this many times. There's been a lot of discussion in the community about drive-thrus and what the drive-thru policy is and everything else. And I know I'm very conscious of drive-thrus myself. And if we were starting from scratch, you know, we might need to have a long discussion, everybody in the city, about just what to do, you know, and what kind of policy to establish. But those horses left the barn quite a while ago, and I think, you know, the best we can do is round them up, right up El Camino Real and Coffee Classics right down 41. So we would hardly have precedent on our side if we were to say that there was some problem with Starbucks having a drive-through here, since drive-throughs are well established in this area. That having been said, I think that there is, as I understand it, a policy about limiting drive-thrus in the downtown district. I think Malibu Brew may have been grandfathered in, but from what I recall, in the downtown district, which would be across Highway 41 and then I think to the south of Traffic Way, there are some limits on them. But in any event, I want to put that on the record. Drive-thrus are something we should be considering whenever we're looking at a conditional use permit and the appropriateness of them. And I think here there's a sound evidentiary basis and policy basis for having and approving this drive-through here. Also, the project looks like a very worthy project. The architectural details are impressive. Starbucks will have an improved presence. Enhanced presence in the community, probably greater sales at this new facility, and that should provide more sales tax revenues. We've gone over many of the details. They seem to have been very thoroughly considered by both the applicant and the staff, and for all these reasons, I'm going to vote in favor of this.
Commissioner Schmidt?
Yeah. Is it proper for me to ask a question of staff?
We've got a motion on the table here. So, is it critical for your vote at the moment?
was more of the last hearing we had a couple of weeks ago, there was a discussion about reciprocal easements. And I'm wondering if there are reciprocal easements here. We have, I was unaware of this piece of land being a separate parcel. And we have multiple users using the driveway. And wondering if there is a reciprocal easement situation set up.
Alfredo.
Do you want to take it?
It's all one parcel.
It's all one parcel. Yeah. We're good.
With Vons and everyone else, that's the same parcel?
Those are separate parcels, and they're not part of the project tonight.
Do they have rights to go across this piece of property?
And be back at 8:35. Thank you. All right, we're going to reconvene our meeting. And we are moving on to item number four, our general plan housing element, land use element, and zoning code map update. And actually, before you start, why don't we just have a quick ex parte, if there is any?
No.
Madam Chair, I must recuse myself due to the fact that I've been elected to City Council, and this will be sent to the City Council. So,
okay,
thank you.
Your room is over there.
Quarantine.
No ex parte on my behalf or on my part, Vice Chairperson. Ex parte.
No ex parte for me.
None.
Thank you. All right, Callie.
Good evening, Commissioners. Our next item tonight is the housing element update for the 2007-2014 planning period. Tonight we're looking at a few items along with the general plan housing element update. The housing element you saw last year in 2009, September last year, and since then we've sent it to the State Department of Housing and Community Development for review, and they have deemed it complete. So now we have that element proposed for adoption for the general plan update. Along with that, we are proposing an upzone to allow a minimum of 20 units per acre in the high-density residential zone. So this would be a change in RMF 16, and that would go up to RMF 20. That includes a general plan land use element, a land use diagram update, a zoning ordinance update, and a zoning map update. In addition to these housing elements, public workshops, multiple city council and planning commission hearings, and then over the past year, the State Department of Housing and Community Development has reviewed the proposed draft housing element. And then we have also completed CEQA review for the housing element. There are a few new policies and programs that we've incorporated into the housing element. And for the most part, these are the same as you reviewed last September. The main ones that we're looking at are the upzoning to 20 units per acre, and that's a minimum density. We're looking at some by right development for emergency and transitional housing sites, vertical mixed use development allowed with a CUP, an update of the city's second unit ordinance. And part of that was already done this summer that you have already approved and was adopted as part of the zoning ordinance. We're looking to adopt an inclusionary housing ordinance that's based on the current policy, explore programs to reduce fees, and adopt a program for the use of RDA and affordable housing in lieu fees. One of the main things that we were looking at with the housing element is an upzoning to meet our RENA numbers. And what this was something that came up during the HCD review. So the state said that we are good to go ahead and have our housing element certified, but Along with that, we also have to accommodate the 505 low and very low units that are remaining from the previous planning period. So that was what we didn't accommodate for in the 2001 to 2006 planning period. So this needs to be done at the same time as the housing element adoption in order to be certified by the state. So, in addition to that 505 from the previous planning period, we have our current shortfall for the 2007 to 2014 planning period, and that's 146 units. So total we have 651 units that we need to accommodate for. So staff is proposing a general plan update, and that's a land use element update in conjunction with this housing element. What we're proposing is to update the high density residential land use designation to be changed from a maximum of 16 dwelling units per acre to a minimum of 20 dwelling units per acre. Along with that, we are proposing to update the mixed-use designations, and that's really just for consistency purposes. The downtown general commercial mixed-use and commercial recreation zones allow for mixed-use projects, so those would also be allowed to develop up to 20 units per acre for residences if a plans and PDs that were already approved. Projects that have been built out to their full capacity, lot size, projects that don't have good access or buildable areas, slope and biological resources such as creeks and trees. So because of all of those factors, we've eliminated 260 of the potential 302 acres of high-density residential. That leaves 42 acres that would be likely to develop to this full 20-unit minimum capacity. Based on those numbers, we would accommodate an additional 784 units more than we have currently. That makes it so we meet our RENA numbers. We are able to get our 651 low and very low units. But then when you compare the 16 dwelling units per acre versus the 20, so basically that extra 4 units per acre of upzone, it's really only an increase of 168 units compared to what we have currently. So this is less than a 5% increase of the total residential units within the city. But it does still meet the RENA numbers, and it makes the city eligible for certification of our housing element.
That's a minimum of 20, though, so really it's a minimum of 168, and it could far exceed that.
That's true. It could exceed that.
Okay.
In conjunction with the general plan land use element update, we're looking at a zoning ordinance update, and this would be to change RMF 16 to RMF 20. So basically just change that zoning designation to be consistent with the general plan, and that would be in the text of the zoning ordinance and on the zoning map. And in conjunction with the residential multifamily designation, we'd also be changing the downtown zoning district for consistency, and that would be allowed up to be changed to the 20-unit minimum dwelling unit per acre as well. As part of the zoning ordinance, we have the hillside density standards, and currently this the density for the hillside standards, the hillside density standards show RMF 16. We'll be changing that to RMF 20 as well, and so staff is proposing to just have the new density be double RMF 10. So where we used to have 16 units per acre would change to 20, and then as the slope goes up, it would go, the number of units allowed per acre would go down. There is additional text that's proposed. This a word was left out in your staff report for the changing maximum to minimum. This was discussed in the staff report, but currently we don't have a good definition for family. The zoning ordinance uses the word family to define dwelling units all throughout the ordinance. But unfortunately, what it does is it identifies it as people that are related, and then it limits it to a maximum of 5 unrelated persons living in a single dwelling unit. So the city attorney has told us that that doesn't comply with fair housing law, so he has recommended a new definition which identifies family as a single housekeeping unit. And basically this just takes out the portion of the definition that talks about people that are related, and it doesn't cap the number of people that are allowed to be in a house. It basically just says that they need to be jointly occupying the unit, that they all agreed to be there together, and it's not something that's rented out by a landlord or property manager two individuals. It's more of a group of people that have agreed to be there together. We're also looking at a few new definitions for single-family dwelling, secondary residential unit, and multifamily dwelling that would use the same language. So staff has posted a negative declaration for the proposed housing element update and the associated general plan and zone changes. And based on the initial study, the project has been found not to create any significant environmental impacts. Staff is recommending that the Planning Commission adopt the four resolutions as provided in your staff report with the modifications shown on the screen. And the Planning Commission may decide to make modifications to the draft housing element before recommending it to City Council. The Commission may determine that more information is needed and send it back to staff, or the Commission may deny the project. But in this case, the housing element would not be certified by the state. And the city's consultant is here if you have additional questions.
Do I have a motion? No, I'm just kidding. I'm in a mood tonight. Just quickly before I forget, I think there is still that typo in the single housekeeping unit definition, landlord or property manager rather than landlord of property manager. It was still up there, so I didn't know if that was changed.
I did not include that text on the screen, so that would be something that would be good to change.
Okay. Thank you. All right, let's start with questions. Vice Chairperson Benz.
Yes. We currently have 16 maximum units, and we're going to 20 minimum.
And it's actually set by region. So regions have different minimum densities. That's 20 is the lowest statewide. Some of the regions have higher minimum densities. There's a whole schedule for the different regions and how they need to deal with the RENA numbers. And this is for the very low and low allocation. But what the thought is that to provide these types of products efficiently and economically, it has to be at a certain density, and that's how they got to the 20 dwelling units per acre. By case studies around the state, looking at how the projects come online, what the threshold is, they got to the minimum of 20 dwellings per acre.
The opposite could not occur, where they would only build 14 units, right? Less than the minimum.
Right, because you set up standard as a minimum. You do have the slope requirements, though, which maybe Kelly could talk a little bit more about. But you set a standard in your code as a minimum, so that's the baseline.
So if the lay of the land won't allow that to be built, mm-hmm. simply because of the slopes and that then they wouldn't be penalized for doing that.
Right. They would not be penalized for doing that. Because in the analysis, and staff did most of this analysis, but it showed that you could meet your allocation with this upzoning process, taking into account slopes and other constraints in certain areas. So that would be satisfactory to the state in terms of certifying your element.
Thank you.
Commissioner Colin Marino.
Yes, I'd just like to follow up on that same subject. The state law, you said, requires it. That it requires it with respect to the HDR areas. Is that right? This, it requires a minimum density of 20 units per acre?
There's different ways to meet the unaccommodated RENA, the allocation, regional housing needs allocation. Based on the circumstances in the city, this was deemed to be the most effective way, was this upzoning process on these parcels, because it... projects are coming in at these densities anyway. It seemed to be effective. Seemed to be in the right areas of the city to accommodate higher densities in these kind of projects. So the state requirements are that to accommodate your very low and low-income numbers that you haven't built and you don't have adequate sites for, they have to be at a minimum of 20 dwelling units per acre. They have to be... the sites have to be large enough to accommodate about 16 units, almost, you know, 3/4 of an acre of site, so you can't have a bunch of little tiny sites. 30, you know, to 35 acres of property. But when we did the analysis, as Callie showed on the slides, if this upzoning would occur in this area, it can accommodate 784 units, which exceeds the city's allocation shortfall.
Now, is there any basis for believing that the market, that there's demand in the market for properties with this kind of density in Atascadero?
That's a good question, and actually we talked about that. But based on trends over several years, this is what the market is producing. So,
What exactly is the market producing? I'm not sure I understand.
Units of this size per acre, 20 units, 24 units per acre in Atascadero and around the region.
So,
In these locations, you know, higher density locations, not in your larger parcels.
So developers are building these types of dwellings, and people are moving into them.
Yes,
and there's an unsatisfied demand for them here.
Yeah, I mean, we haven't done specific market analysis for a new project in the city, but based on trends, what's been going in, vacancy rates, rents, all those sort of economic indicators, things we track generally, yeah, there's a demand, there's a need. There's a need for that product type. I would say we're underbuilt in that product type regionally. So, I mean, it was a concern for us, I think, that... this upzone process and wasn't appropriate for the city and didn't make sense. And after going through the thought process and analysis, the trends in the city and regionally, we came to the conclusion that it would work. There is a market out there. This is what developers are interested in, these kind of parcels and land inventory. So we felt comfortable with the recommendation. And it is in compliance with state law, but I think it does make sense for the city.
Well, first of all, the state law probably doesn't take into account any concern for market demand or anything else, right? They just require that you have a certain amount of property zoned in this way without regard to whether anything will ever be built in that zone, I assume, right?
That's true to some extent, yeah.
Okay, and then the next thing is, are we at risk here of having a lot of land that is zoned in this
property?
Right.
And one of the issues under state law is once you upzone it to meet the allocation state law, you can't downzone it either because you've identified those sites for your allocation. Honestly, one of the issues for the city is that because the previous housing element wasn't certified, we have a bigger number to deal with than we would have anyway. And that's a little bit of a predicament that we're in at this time. So the previous RENA was... 505 units. So that's part of what we're trying to address this time, too, which is what's bumping the numbers up quite a bit and kind of making us look at larger areas of property.
But I guess I'm concerned that our effort to satisfy the state law requirements may compel us to blight the community in the downtown area because there may not be many developers or not enough developers, let's say, interested to in building properties so densely in Atascadero.
One thing to keep in mind, these numbers sound kind of like a big change. We're not actually adding any more high-density residential. So all the vacant land that we're talking about is vacant high-density residential today, and it's been that way for the last 10 years. We're not creating a new inventory. Those parcels already exist as vacant high-density. Really what we're doing is we're saying today you could build 16 units the acre. After this is approved, you could build a minimum of 20. So it's still the same parcels. We're just adding an additional entitlement. It's obviously going to be up to the market to decide when it's economically feasible. The state doesn't say we have to build them. We just have to provide the mechanism and the planning that allows the market to build them if the market chooses to build them. So I wouldn't get too concerned about, neighborhood blight type issues or that sort of thing. I mean, these are the same parcels that we've been driving by for the last 10 or 15 years. We're hoping that actually by adopting the element and simplifying the process and removing barriers, it'll make it easier for those parcels to develop in the future rather than, the current situation where maybe they've sat vacant for a number of decades.
So nobody was willing to build on these parcels when they could only build 16 units. So now we're hoping that now they're required to build more than 20, they might be more inclined to
It's an issue of absorption. The city has built more housing than almost any other city, so we were building housing as fast as we could. We had a huge inventory of vacant land just because of the way Atascadero was. So we were in, they want to develop it, and it's one of these 4 acres, and they're very interested in the new entitlement, the ability to build at a higher density. So I think it's just the process, and that's what we're planning for. We're planning for, you know, the long-term horizon, and these changes seem like they make sense.
Yeah, and once we get the downtown turned into a very attractive, magnetic area, everyone's going to want to move down here and live in these kind of units. I think that's what we're all hoping for, right?
Yes, that's part of the program, the downtown infill.
Vice Chairperson Betts.
Yes. The state sets the number of units that we're to provide. The council must zone to allow those units, but the free market is what determines whether or not any units are built on that. In addition, this commission has stated that they would like to see incentives, the city provide incentives to allow this low and moderate income housing to start being developed in our community. And so that's what we're sitting here about is, you know, we've instructed staff that we'd like to see something done about the $45,000 that they got to buy, that the city gets in permit fees for an individual single family home, as well as $37,000 to $40,000 on multifamily units. And then you take a look at the processing time, and the processing time goes 3 months, 6 months, 8 months. And all of those are issues that government issues that are impacting the government's ability to provide low and moderate income housing units to the population. So I think we're seeing the results of what this commission has discussed many times in the past about when are we going to do something about this? And this is why it's before us today. Thank you.
Commissioner Ward.
This might be a silly question, but is that minimum of 20 units, is that prorated if somebody has 3/4 acre?
Yes.
Okay. And I read somewhere in the depths of this, if there's requirement to remove some very nice oak trees or something like that, or there's other significant terrain features, creeks, etc., that
and thus reducing the potential that's on the property. And the difference between what we're dealing with this state law is that in the past, if it didn't develop, we could change the zoning. Now we can't change the zoning, and so we are stuck with that. I think that comments were made, appropriate comments about, you know, we might be building or wanting to build these things, but right now nothing is being built for specific reasons, the obviously the economy. And with the question to Callie, did I hear you say at the very beginning of your presentation that one of the programs included the potential at looking at a reduction of fees?
Yes, it does. There's a couple programs that look at fee reduction analysis, one with the water meters, and then just fees in general. Because it was a Planning Commission concern last time we were here over a year ago, we made a lot of revisions to the housing element to address those concerns.
So primarily what we're talking about is development impact fees in this case. The water company has already made a reduction in their fees for multiple residential units. They reduced it 35%. What we need is the city has to do the same. And if we're interested in people meeting these minimums of 20 units per acre, there has to be a proportionate reduction in the fees. I mean, if you're going to still, I mean, if I have to build 20, I'm not going to build 25 if I have to do $40,000 times 5 again. I mean, it's just not going to happen.
If you look at page 416, number 13, would that be it, Lisa, to encourage the development of, you talk about second units, but I think elsewhere here, too, there's something about incentives.
That's one of the programs, yeah, program 13 on that page. Mm-hmm. And then there's program 618, back a little bit further, looking at fees, too. I think it's the very last program. I actually think the Planning Commission crafted it mm-hmm. last time we were here.
Okay.
I think it's more of, as has been stated, it has to be taken on seriously, and there are ways in which it can be done. And, for instance, we have, I think it's called the TAES study, which developed our capital improvement fee program. And, again, that study looks at a dwelling. It doesn't distinguish between what type of dwelling. They're all the same. If I build an 800-square-foot home, my impact fee is the same as if I build a 5,000-square-foot home. I mean, it isn't the single source of why things aren't happening.
So the way it's written in here, is that satisfying what you're talking about, that they're going to be looking into that, or do you
I think
trying to clarify
it does satisfy me, but I'm just kind of emphasizing that the council, we should provide council direction within our recommendation that the first thing that they should consider is directing staff or consultants to dive into the fee program. A classic, again, is the second home. I mean, our individual homes already pay for police, for fire, for parks. And you can't have a second home on a lot without a primary home first, right? And so, but the fees for a second home are going to be the same. But they should be reduced because that lot is already paying some fees for those things. And those things need to be looked at. Again, the water company reduced theirs 35%. The city should look at an analysis of some type and find that a certain type of home or a certain size of home doesn't generate the same impact. Therefore, they don't need to pay as much. And to me, it's preeminent that our recommendation include to the council, take this on first.
Thank you. Vice Chairperson Benz. Yeah.
Another question. If a property owner has a high HDR lot, and they could accommodate 30 units of low and moderate income housing. They could do it. They could. The city would be obligated to approve that, wouldn't they? And so, way back when we first started with low and moderate income housing and we clustered them, they failed because they were clustered. Are we doing the same thing? Backing up Lynn, Commissioner Colin Marino's idea.
Well, actually, with the up zone, what happens is it could be market rate or affordable housing either way. So you could have a mixed income project in those areas. And the other program in the housing element is an inclusionary ordinance, which would be a percentage of a unit, a percentage of a development would be affordable too. So in that way, we're trying to get away from some of the issues with
We have control over not allowing 100 units on a particular lot that's all low and moderate income housing.
If a 100% affordable project came through from people's self-help housing or an affordable housing developer, and it met the zoning ordinance requirements, the city would have to process that through the normal channels.
Okay, I understand that. But the city can set...
Microphone. Microphone.
The city can still set the mix. 15% shall be this, 30% shall be this, and another 20% shall be this.
If we... When we do an inclusionary project, then we do have that mix that we set. Now, what we're doing here, though, with these minimum densities, the assumption is because the densities are higher that the project will be more affordable. So, therefore, there isn't a requirement to deed restrict it. The state's just going to assume if you're building at these densities, you're meeting your housing obligations. So we don't have to go through and deed restrict, you know, X percent is low. So these projects can be market rate. They can figure out whatever their mix is. So we don't get into the process of setting that. We'll still have inclusionary, but the inclusionary mainly applies to the specific plans like the Eagle Ranch that are mainly single family that have a tendency not to produce affordable units on their own. But in these high density zones, which we're talking about here, they'll still be market rate projects. It's just the assumption is the higher density will produce the affordability or the more affordable type housing.
But I want to make sure that I understand this. If a property owner came in and wanted to build 100 very low income units,
they can do that.
They can do that.
They have
that,
the right
the
to do it.
City could not stop that.
Right. We could make sure it's built to our standards and it would not be a nuisance. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't require that, but they have the option if they want to propose that.
So if too many very low or built, then you're going to have a decaying process.
Well, typically nobody builds that unless these projects have tax credits and a bunch of other things built into it and investors. And typically, because of the investment model behind them, there's a high level of management and quality that are typically built into these projects, not like they were maybe
that we had back in the 70s and 80s.
Would this also be helped by the two-story limit? I would think that that's still in there, if I remember reading correctly. We still have that two-story limit, the 30-foot height restriction.
Yes, that is still in the ordinance. We allow that to be waived through a CUP, so it would be reviewed mm-hmm. by the Planning Commission.
And Ms. Wise, you had something?
I just wanted to add on that comment about those large developments. These deed-restricted projects, the financing is heavily regulated, and they have to do really detailed market studies that makes sense in the location, that there's a market there, that the product sizes are right. So it would have to meet a lot of regulations or requirements in the funding sources from the underwriters, the banks, et cetera. I also wanted to say that, you know, you'd have to have the parcel sizes to meet that type of development, which would be 5 acres, which is large. And then thirdly, I wanted just to point out that all cities are doing this. So, you know, everybody's not going to come to a Tascadero because we're doing something unusual. Everybody's upzoning. There's this minimum 20 DU per acre countywide for all these very low and low income units, so that, you know, we're going to be in the same position here as we are with other local jurisdictions.
Commissioner Colomarino.
Yes, I just wanted to follow up on something that Director Frace mentioned. I think I understood you to say that the parcels that are built in the high density area, 20 units or more, are not subject to the requirement of having a certain number of them low income and next to low income or what have you, and they're not deed restricted. Is that correct?
That's correct. Currently, we have an inclusionary housing policy. It's not an ordinance, it's a policy. So it only applies to projects that require a legislative approval, which is a plan development. Typically, the only trigger for a plan development is that you want a small lot subdivision of some sort. So if you're just building an apartment project that doesn't include a subdivision, it's typically just a use permit, and therefore the inclusionary policy doesn't kick in. And there is no inclusionary requirement on multifamily projects typically. And it actually seems like that works out pretty well because it doesn't constrain these multifamily projects that tend to be affordable. It mainly applies to single-family subdivisions, like I said, that tend not to produce as many affordable inclusionary because it's part of the zone change. But most of these lots that we're talking about tonight that are part of the study already are zoned correctly as multifamily, and therefore they won't require a rezone, so they won't be subject to inclusionary.
So basically, that's some incentive, I guess, to build on these lots too. You don't have to worry about dealing with the inclusionary requirements and deed restrictions.
Yeah, I think it's more flexibility for the developer. So hopefully, that is an incentive.
I see. Thank you.
I have a few questions. So, am I clear then that if we want to be compliant, we cannot place a maximum. We can't say a maximum of 30 units or something like that in order for us to be compliant with the housing element.
Actually, you can set a maximum if you wanted to. I don't think it's in the language tonight, but you could set a maximum density.
Oh. Is there a reason why staff didn't choose to set a maximum?
We want to attract high rises.
We've got our 30-foot limit, though.
Control stalls.
Not that I know of. I think we were reading into the letter of the law, and you know, not taking that extra step, but you can set a maximum. The state law only sets a minimum, so that threshold is met. But a maximum could be considered. So that may be the recommendation you want to make to City Council for staff to investigate that and take that recommendation forward.
Okay. I noticed that initially there were three at-risk units, and now there's only one. Does that mean the other two have been favorably resolved? That's what it seemed to be.
Can you repeat the question?
Sure. In the initial report, there were three at-risk complexes, and mm-hmm. now there's only one. So the other two were resolved favorably then?
Yeah, we needed to go back, and that was actually one of the state's comments, were the units at risk. And in the end, California Manor was a major project. There was about 95 units there. Staff may be able to get an update, but there was a potential buyer. They were looking at tax credit funding. I believe that's still all moving forward.
Okay. And the other two are all fine now?
Yes.
Okay. And then, Ms. Wise, I was wondering if you could let me know, I mean, can the state just keep telling us you have to grow more and more and more?
It's hard to predict what the state's going to do, but...
Agreed.
The trends have been that every 5 to 7 years they come up with a new allocation process, but once your housing element is certified, you sort of start with a clean slate. So you went through the process, you planned for your units, you faithfully or to the best of your ability implemented your housing element. Recognize you don't build housing, you just, you know, do what you can as a city to reduce regulations.
Right.
So then when when a new allocation comes down through the state, you would go through a similar process like this. But with this up zone, the city should be in a good position to accommodate additional numbers. Because they would take the vacant land into account that was undeveloped at that time. It sort of starts a clean slate and a clean clock.
If you say clean slate, does that mean suddenly the 505 and the 146?
Yeah.
That suddenly those go away? Yes. And so we have now allocated the 784, and they could come in with a number that's 750, and that's okay because we have 784. And I know I'm kind of simplifying it. But you're
on the right path.
Okay.
Yes. So... do you have your allocation this time? You get certified. You can accommodate 784 units. You don't build anything. Your new allocation comes down next time. You need 200 units. You got plenty of property, vacant land.
And that 651 is now gone.
Yes.
It's just the 200 that we're concerned with. And okay.
Yeah. Because what happens is when they do the new numbers and the new population projections, they're kind of starting over, too. They're saying, okay, you're this big now. You know, 5 or 7 years later, how much more are you going to grow? What are your housing needs and all that? So they kind of redo their calculations, too, at that point in time.
That must be their incentive then part of the incentive for getting certified, because it makes no sense whatsoever that they left the prior allocation on for us to deal with right now.
That's part of the incentive. There are other incentives. They're tying a lot of state funding to certified housing elements.
Yeah, like lawsuits and things like that.
There's
a lot of
issues,
incentives.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Okay, I think those are my questions. I want to go ahead and open it up to the public. Anyone who would like to speak on this matter, if you come to the lectern, and you can use the switch up there to turn the microphone on. Let us know your name.
A lot of differences, both in how we work and how you are able to address housing and other issues in the community. The Housing Trust Fund is a nonprofit corporation that has the mission of increasing the supply of affordable housing throughout the county. We provide technical assistance and financing for affordable housing projects. We've been a partner with the city of Atascadero for about 6 years now in promoting affordable housing in the community. The city has provided a total of $42,000 to support our operations, and we've loaned about over $1.7 million for affordable housing projects in the city. I look forward to continuing to work together to help make more affordable housing possible within the community. The higher density housing that we're talking about is really critical for the workforce in Atascadero and throughout the county. Where else will the people who work for Walmart live? Where else will the people who work for Starbucks live? We need to have housing that people who earn between $30,000 and $50,000 a year can live. And these are precisely the units that we're talking about. While people are concerned about the significant increase from 16 to 20 units per acre, you really have to focus on the fact that only 170 additional units will be allowed forever. And that will only increase the total number of units possible in the city by 1.2% at build-out. So it is really a small number. And the units are concentrated along the transportation corridors. Most neighborhoods will not even notice that they're built, but they will provide housing for people who work in the community. The other things that you're looking at tonight are items that you already do or are in the process of doing. The inclusionary ordinance is a policy that you've been implementing for at least 5 years. The second unit changes have been in process, and you've been up.
All right, seeing none, I will close public comment and bring it back to the commission for any discussion. No? Maybe a motion?
I would move that the Planning Commission adopt Resolution PC 2010-0025, recommending that the City Council certify proposed negative declaration 2010-005 and adopt Resolution PC 2010-0026, recommending that the City Council adopt the Atascadero 2007-2014 housing element, PLN 2009-1328 and GPA 2009-0025, based on findings, and adopt Resolution PC 2010-0027, recommending that the City Council approve a general plan land use element update and general plan land use diagram update, PLN 2009-1328, GPA 2009-0025, to allow a minimum density of 20 units per acre in the high density residential land use designation, and adopt Resolution PC 2010-0028, recommending that the City Council introduce an ordinance for first reading by title only to approve zoning code and zoning map updates, PLN 2009-1328, ZCH 2010-0162, to change RMF 16 to RMF 20 and update zoning ordinance definitions related to housing based on findings. And my motion includes Callie's adjustment and the chairperson's adjustment.
I'll second it.
Okay, we have a motion by Vice Chairperson Bence and a second by Commissioner Colomarino. Commissioner Schmidt.
Would the first and the second agree to include strong direction to the City Council to initiate study to look at changes to our development impact fee structure?
Maker of the motion agrees.
I wouldn't use the term strong direction. I think recommendation is about as far as we ought to go. I think if we say that we recommend it,
the first thing that they do.
So a high density.
Maker of the motion would agree to that?
I don't really think that's necessary. I think that the market can determine that. There is, as you mentioned, a height limitation on buildings that's applicable. And, you know, if somebody wants to build a 35-unit building, they think it's going to work and there's a market for it. I'm not, I mean, without some evidence, without some reason to believe that there is a problem presented by, some maximum or by the absence of a maximum.
Well, and that's why I asked is that staff investigate a possible maximum. So I'm not saying to recommend that, hey, City Council put a maximum on this, but have staff investigate, is there a potential need for this? And they could say, no, there's not, and they go on their way. But I think just based on our conversation here tonight, we all expressed a little bit of concern that, well, gosh, there doesn't seem to be a maximum. Could there be some concerns? And so I just think it might be something that we could recommend the City Council have staff investigate.
How about we not make it part of the motion, but we state as the commission that we would like the City Council to visit the subject of establishing a maximum.
Or can we just recommend that to the staff? I mean, is that something that the Planning Commission can suggest to the staff before bringing it up to the City Council?
No, because we'd have to come back to it. So we're recommending it to the council. And the council can choose to say, well, we don't take your recommendation. So we're just saying to a council, we'd like to recommend this. And they can say, hey, great idea. Or, you know, no, we'll let the market decide. Ignore it.
I'm not worried about it myself, but I'll go along and second if the maker of the motion wants to add it to his motion.
All right. I think we have agreement.
One clarification, Madam Chair. On prioritizing the fee study, one thing you could suggest is policy 13 on page 81 has a time frame of 3 years to it. To do that study, you could change that to 1 year, and I think that would achieve what you're looking at and trying to make that a top priority in the first year. So that would be one way to achieve that clearly in your policy document.
Okay. Let's see. Where is that on page 81?
Policy, it's page 416.
Number 13, it talks about fees for second units, and it has a within a three-year time frame. And then if you go to page 426, number 8 talks about fees, in general for affordable units, and that says within 1 year. So I think it does make sense to combine those.
For all
I would agree with that analysis.
I would extend it to all units. I mean, I wouldn't limit it to the second homes or the affordable homes. It's just a fee structure that needs to be looked at for all situations because it is prohibitive. And so, they would have to, we're saying within 1 year of the adoption of this ordinance, that they would have to take some type of action? Or?
Could you clarify that, Director?
Yeah, I think policy 8 on page 426 is all housing units, so it would be inclusive of all our densities to look at that. Mm-hmm. If the council adopts it, then that will set a one-year schedule for completing that study.
Perfect.
Yep. So does that mean we can have an unadulterated motion here?
No, it does mean that on number 13 that you want to change that to within 1 year. So it's then consistent with number 8 on the following section.
Maker of the motion agrees to the change on what item was it?
Item 13.
Item 13 to 1 year.
Second.
All right. I got everything in that? You're good. All right. With that, roll call, please.
Vice Chairperson Benz?
Yes.
Commissioner Colomarino?
Yes.
Commissioner Schmidt?
Yes.
Commissioner Ward?
Yes.
And Chairperson Moreno?
Yes.
Motion passes 5-0.
Thank you. All right, and we have Commissioner Comments and Reports. Vice Chairperson Benz.
Yes. I know we just passed a motion, but I'm very concerned with the time limits that it takes to process these applications. and I'd like to have a study done to at least investigate how staff might be able to speed up the process for getting these permits processed, because that is a condition that discourages developers when they're trying to, when time means to buy the low and moderate income housing that's needed to the community. It's not part of the motion, it's just that I, as a commissioner, believe that the time it takes to process it is also a detriment to getting applications before us. Thank you.
Commissioner Schmidt.
Yes, a few things. I was fortunate to be at a public hearing last night in Grover Beach, and there were some wonderful things that happened there. And one of them was the city has been working with the school district and inviting a student to come in and lead the Pledge of Allegiance. And there was a young man who came in last night, and his grandma was there, and his sister, and his brother, and his whole family, and they were taking pictures for the paper, and this person was very proud of what he did. And I would offer that something that we might consider either as a planning commission or as a city council. They also had a stimulus program, which they were doing, which was almost like if you go to a coffee shop and you buy 10 coffees and you get the punches on the card and you get a free one afterwards. And so they had something similar to that. And they had people who were issued cards from restaurants or participating vendors. And they were given put into a pot. And they drew out 10 of them. And each of these individuals received a some type of package that would have given discounts at businesses in town, and I thought that was really nice also. And then lastly, tonight is the last night for the commissioner to my left here, and I've truly appreciated having him sit next to me, and I truly appreciated the friendship and the camaraderie of you being here, and I know you're going to do well as a city council person, but I'm going to miss you, and I want to thank you for the time and getting to know you.
Thank you.
Well, thank you. And I just wanted to say that it has truly been an honor to work with all of you and to be able to be on this commission and to serve the city in this capacity. I've really enjoyed it, and to get to know each and every one of you, and just the opportunity to talk and deliberate and to just put our heads together and figure these things out has really been I really enjoyed it. So thank you very much.
Well, this, and I'm grateful for the honor to have served. So thank you.
I apologize. Sometimes I overlook things, and I apologize for not recognizing you, Heather.
He's your favorite. That's okay.
You have done a wonderful job as chair, and you have been the we joked before, is like you had your harem with you with us all up here, the one woman in the sky.
We didn't joke
like
about that publicly.
But you've done a wonderful job, and again, I apologize for
that. So you don't forget further, it will be Commissioner Colin Marino's last night as well. So, and
same
a thank
to you.
You to you.
And on that point, let me just say that it's been a pleasure serving with all of you. And Brian, I wish you well on the City Council. And it's been a very nice experience. And I think a productive one for all of us. And I look forward to working together in the future on various matters that arise in the city of Atascadero.
Thank you.
Thank you. Commissioner Ward, did you have something to?
Yes. Well, first of all, if I'm going to get my butt kicked in a city council election by a fellow planning commissioner, I can't think of any nicer guy than having it done by except Brian, and you're going to make a wonderful city council member, and I'll look forward to doing my little three-minute thing up in Electron every now and then. I wish you well, and as I said in a letter to the editor a while ago, I think the city is going to be well served with you on the city council.
Thank you, Chair.
Now, second thing, about a week or so ago, I was reviewing a five- or six-page form I made out 2 years ago for an application to be an at-large planning commissioner. And in that, I had to put down my goals and objectives and what I hope would be accomplished. And one thing, and it's not necessarily something that I did, but something that I observed, and that is that the entire attitude, and I say this to the staff, but the entire attitude on the way the city handles builders, developers, homeowners, rather than an adversarial thing where everybody's taking positions and trying to gain points. So that was one little thing I had on there that I hope would be accomplished, not necessarily by me, but would be just accomplished by the whole system. And I want to compliment all those that have been involved in that. You got it done.
Very good.
And I was very proud to serve on the Planning Commission. And if either by one route or another, I hope to serve another two-year term. So,
thank you, Commissioner.
It's been a wonderful experience, and I had some of this background before, but looking at this 500-page thing, I'm glad this was thrust in front of me on the last day.
470, Chuck. You're overblowing it there. Thank you. Vice Chairperson Benz.
Yes. There's one thing that I would like to comment to every commissioner that sits here today. I know every one of you care and care a lot about this city. And as a result of your caring, I think I'm a better person than I was when I first came on board. I learn from each and every one of you. I appreciate each and every one of you, and I consider each and every one of you a kind, compassionate, and understanding person. As for staff, I think there's none better, because you also care, and you probably care too much. But that's a good quality. So thank you very much for allowing me to be a part of this whole program that is designed to bring about a well-deserved change in the community. Thank you.
Thank you. And with that, Director, we'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you. So in terms of our schedule, as we mentioned, we're not going to have a meeting on December 21st. And we're worried about quorum come January. So our next meeting then would be January 4th, which would be right after New Year's, and we may not have a quorum, even have a meeting. So staff-wise, we're going to try to push everything off to the 18th just to avoid trying to consultant. That'll get the Eagle Ranch project off and running. There'll be a lengthy process of project design, community outreach, special study sessions with commission and council on the Eagle Ranch project in the first half of next year. So that's going to be a big project coming at us fairly quickly. Also, the Walmart project is moving ahead as well. We expect the EIR to be out for public review in January, and that we'll be ready for public hearings come spring. So that's another project that's moving along. So although there might be a little lull here for a month or so, we're going to have some big projects moving very quickly come the first of the year. And then just economic development updates. AutoZone has submitted permits for the Hollywood Video building. So they've purchased that property, it appears, and they're going to take all three suites that were there and make that into an AutoZone store. So we're happy about that. Planning and building is working on expediting that. The Colony Square Galaxy Theater projects moving ahead very quickly. You see those giant foam blocks that are out there? Those are actually the raised floor for the stadium seating. So those blocks are all getting put in there, and then they pour a concrete floor on top of that that will hold the seats. So it's moving along quite nicely. The application for the decorative exterior sign, which would be very fancy, kind of like what you see at the Fremont Theater in downtown San Luis. That's the type of signage they're going to be putting on there for the theater. That just came in as well, so we're excited about that. And let's see, Caro's. Caro's is going to be remodeled as a Coco's. So the company that owns Caro's also owns the brand Coco's. So they're going to do a total redo, reface, repackage of that restaurant to kind of modernize and clean it up. So we're thinking that's going to be a nice one, too. It sounds like that's supposed to start construction first of the year. So that'll conclude my report. Wish everybody a happy holiday and happy New Year.
Happy holiday, Merry Christmas, Happy New Year, and for the last time, meeting adjourned.